What would you do if your family carried a curse written in their blood, a mysterious condition that made water the very source of life, an agent of death? For nearly a century, one family in Kerala, India, has lived under this shadow, watching generation after generation succumb to drowning in the shallowest of waters. This isn't just a medical mystery, it's a profound meditation on how we carry the weight of inherited trauma, how love persists despite loss, and how the search for answers can span lifetimes. Abraham Verghese's sprawling epic follows three generations bound by this condition, weaving together a tapestry of arranged marriages, forbidden love, colonial medicine, and ultimately, the redemptive power of truth. Set against Kerala's lush waterways, where coconut palms thrive and rivers serve as highways, the story asks, can we ever truly escape what runs in our veins, or must we instead learn to understand it? A 12-year-old girl prepares to marry a 40-year-old widower she's never met. Her mother warns, the saddest day of a girl's life is the day of her wedding. After that, God willing, it gets better. She overhears whispers about drownings in the groom's family, the first hint of the condition that will define her life. Her reluctant groom attempts to flee upon seeing her youth, but tradition prevails, and she travels by boat to Perambil, a sprawling 500-acre estate. What transforms this arranged marriage isn't grand romance, but small recognitions. Her husband sleeps outside near Damodaran, a one-eyed elephant he once saved. When she prepares perfectly spiced mutton, he finally speaks directly. He'd kept his distance so she wouldn't feel intimidated. On her 16th birthday, Damodaran mysteriously appears, somehow knowing what no one else remembered. That night, their marriage is consummated, and she discovers that love isn't ownership, but extension finding yourself reflected in another. Now called Big Amachi, she awakens one morning to profound melancholy. When she confesses worry about her mother, her husband, and Shamuel disappear, returning with her mother thin, white-haired, aged beyond recognition. As they embrace, their roles reverse. The mother returns to safety in her daughter's arms. With her own daughter's birth, Big Amachi's body belongs to a beloved tyrant, demanding milk from breasts she barely recognizes as her own. Then comes the day that fractures everything. Jojo, her stepson who avoids water but masters tree climbing, falls face first into a rain-filled drainage ditch during a stunt. Despite frantic efforts pumping water from his lungs, breathing into his mouth, Jojo remains stubbornly lifeless. In her grief, Big Amachi harbors a shameful thought, trading her infant's life for Jojo's. That evening, she appeals directly to God. Lord, maybe you don't want to cure this for reasons I don't understand, but if you won't or can't, then send us someone who can. Her prayer sets in motion events that will ripple across decades. In 1919, Glasgow, 10-year-old Digby's mother, loses her factory job for organizing a strike. They move in with his grandmother, who calls him the bastard. Through 7 years of poverty, his mother insists he stay in school. It's only you being top of the class that gets me through this hell. When he earns a medical scholarship, he returns home to find she's hanged herself with his school tie. By 1933, 25-year-old Digby works at Longmere Hospital in Madras, where native wards overflow while the British ward stands empty. His affair with Celeste, his supervisor's dissolute wife, awakens something dormant in both until a tipped candle ignites turpentine-soaked rags. Celeste dies trapped under her burning sari. Digby's desperate rescue leaves him with burned hands and a scarred face, a surgeon whose tools have been destroyed. Swedish physician Rune Orkvist examines his damaged hands with profound sorrow, then offers to repair them and give him purpose at his leprosarium. Years later, Big Amachi's son, Philippos, returns from Madras Christian College, where undiagnosed hearing impairment made lectures impossible. He brings home trunks of books, determined that novels, the great lies that tell the truth, can always be mine. On the train, he meets Elsie, an artist from a wealthy family who chooses him because he'll understand her ambitions. On their wedding night, feeling magnanimous, Philippos promises Elsie anything she desires. When she asks to cut down the jackfruit tree outside their window, he hesitates. The tree holds sentimental value. Though Elsie withdraws her request, this unkept promise festers beneath their passionate marriage. After their son Ninon is born prematurely, Philippos finally orders the tree cut, but preserves the trunk as an ugly scarecrow-like form. As the long-awaited monsoon arrives, Philippos stands with his face upturned to the covenant of water. But this piece precedes catastrophe. Ninon drowns, poisoning their marriage beyond repair. 6 months after Ninon's death, Big Amachi's desperate letters bring Elsie back gaunt but beautiful in white. Baby Mole revives with her return, but Philippos sinks into opium. When he finds Elsie violently ill one night, his mother's cryptic comment about needing the sleep of two people reveals the truth. Elsie is pregnant. He interprets this as divine redemption. After a harrowing breech delivery, Big Amachi presents Philippos with his newborn daughter. His joy vanishes. It's not a son. "God has failed us again," he mutters. More disturbing is Elsie's inexplicable sorrow. She gazes tenderly at her daughter but won't hold her, turning away in tears. After 3 weeks, Elsie vanishes, leaving folded clothes by the river. In her nest, Big Amachi finds a drawing weighted by stone, an older woman holding a baby, Elsie's farewell entrusting Mariama to her care. What Big Amachi doesn't yet know is why Elsie couldn't hold her daughter and what secret she carried to her staged drowning.
Years later, Mariama becomes a doctor dedicated to understanding the family condition. After her father's death in a train accident, she discovers acoustic neuromas on both sides of his brain, tumors affecting his balance and hearing, leaving him unable to orient himself in water. The condition isn't a curse, but hereditary disease. She becomes a neurosurgeon, mapping the water tree and discovering other Christian families in Kerala share the drowning condition. When Lennon appears at St. Bridget's Leprosarium with condition symptoms, Mariama performs emergency surgery, saving his life. Searching her father's journals, she discovers a shocking truth. He wasn't her biological father. Elsie had left for over a year after Ninon's death and returned pregnant. Confronting Digby at St. Bridget's, Mariama learns the woman in the garden who fails to blink, a sign of nerve damage from leprosy, is Elsie, her mother, living at the leprosarium for years. Digby reveals he found Elsie in 1950 after her child's death caused her to flee. When Elsie received a letter about Baby Mole's illness, she returned to Parambil, promising to come back. 8 months later, she gave birth, but had developed leprosy during pregnancy. She couldn't hold her newborn, knowing the danger. She staged her drowning to protect her daughter from stigma. "I died last night so that my daughter might live a normal life." Standing before the French windows, Mariama instinctively places her palms against the glass, overlapping her blind mother's outstretched hands. The barrier between their worlds momentarily dissolved.